Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I'm not complaining. And you are Barbara Bradley Haggerty.
That's right.
Do you want to tell people who you are?
Okay. I'm the religion correspondent for National Public Radio. And I just came out with a book called Fingerprints of God, The Search for the Science of Spirituality.
Yes, you did. In fact, I'm holding it up in front of the camera. And as I was saying to you before we started recording, it's one of those books where wherever you dip into it, you want to keep reading because, there are a lot of people claiming to have found evidence of, something kind of spiritual or religious or something. And if you're a believer, you want to keep reading in hopes of confirming your beliefs. And if you're a skeptic, you want to keep reading so that you can debunk the thing. So I would think you've got the best of both worlds here.
Well, I've angered a lot of people on both sides. I'm not sure I satisfied anyone.
Anger's okay as long as it's a commercially motivating force.
That's right.
And I wrote this book, The Evolution of God, which is also God-related. I think we should talk mostly about your book, and then if mine comes into play naturally at any point, I would not be totally averse to discussing it. But why don't you... Do you want to say a little bit about your background or the nature of your interests? Because you took time off for, a year from NPR to investigate this? What was the motivation?
Well, I took a year off. The motivation actually, oddly enough for a journalist to admit, came from a mystical, kind of spiritual mystical experience that I, in fact, had back in 1994. And... I'll just tell you briefly, I was doing a story for the LA Times Sunday magazine. I'd left the Christian Science Monitor, was working on a book that I ended up deciding not to do. And I was freelancing for the LA Times Sunday magazine about doing a story about why some churches grow and others don't. And I was out in California at a little place called Saddleback Church. No one really knew about Saddleback back then, but now everyone knows about Rick Warren. And I was interviewing a woman named Kathy Young. Kathy was, we were sitting, it was at night, it was a Saturday night after the service, and we're sitting in the, underneath the street light, and it was kind of a mysterious setting anyway. And she was telling me about the fact that her melanoma had returned, but that she didn't see that return of the melanoma as an attempt by God to kill her, but to give her a transcendent purpose. And it was a really pretty powerful thing to say. And as I was listening to her and her spiritual journey, Bob, what happened was kind of eerie. It was as if someone stepped inside the circle of light that we were sitting in and breathed on us. It was as if the air grew moist and thick. And it was spooky. And it was spooky enough that both of us noticed it. She stopped talking mid-sentence. So this just wasn't me.
And you had noticed it before she stopped talking, or do you remember?
Yeah, no, I had noticed it. I'd noticed it for maybe five seconds or so, and then she clearly got a sense that something was going on here, and she just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat there for about 30 seconds, and it was pretty spooky, I've got to tell you. Around 30 seconds later, this feeling receded. And everything was back to normal, and as I said, I was a bit spooked, and so I shut down the interview very, very quickly, went back to Los Angeles, drove back there that night, and then was basically plagued with this question, what happened? Was I crazy? Was that a delusion? Is there, in fact, a God who can come and breathe on you when you're sitting under a circle of light? And so that was back in 1994. It took me a while to muster up the courage to go ahead and try to explore these questions of whether we could, whether there is something more than this and what science has to say about it. Mm-hmm. Because really, in many ways, science is the religion of the 21st century. And so I thought, people believe science. Let's take a look and see what science has to say. And that was really the impetus for my doing this. And I became religion, came to NPR a little bit later, 1995, the end of that year. And in 2003, began reporting on religion and took off a year in 2006 to do this book.
Okay, and before you go on about what you did find in the course of your researches, did you discuss this with her immediately thereafter?
No, I waited about 2 weeks, and then I called her up. because I just couldn't forget it. I was back mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., and I couldn't forget it. And I called her up, and she said, I am so glad you called. I've been thinking about that moment. It was, and she actually wrote it down for me and sent it to me in a letter about a year later. Hmm. So this was, we kind of shared, compared notes, and we really felt virtually the same thing.
Well, I've got to say that that's harder to explain than just one person having that experience. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to explain one person having the experience. The synchronicity is a little more challenging. But so what did you well, you can as you prefer, you can either talk about what you discovered or tell us how you view that experience now, having done all of your study on this.
Right. Well, you know, I actually think there's a way to explain it both materialistically and spiritually, okay? Oren Devinsky, who's at NYU, the Epilepsy Center at NYU, mm-hmm. Talked about this with me. I asked him, what was going on here? He's a specialist in epilepsy. The temporal lobe, you could say, is kind of the sweet spot for spiritual experience. It seems to be activated mm-hmm. During spiritual experience, or that's what they believe. I said, you know, what was this, just firing an electrical storm in my temporal lobe? What was going on? And he said, you know, it's really hard to know. Clearly something was going on physically in the temporal lobe.
Okay, we had a brief technical interruption there, but we think we remember roughly where we were. And Barbara, you're now going to pick up where we think that was, right?
I was talking about the fact that I think that experience can be explained kind of materially or spiritually, the experience that I had with Kathy Young. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Oren Devinsky, who is at the Epilepsy Center at NYU, and I asked him about it. I said, you know, was I crazy? What was going on? He studies the temporal lobe, and the temporal lobe appears to be kind of the sweet spot for spirituality. In other words, when you have an electrical firing in the brain or some ecstatic seizures in the temporal lobe seem to provoke the spiritual experience. So I said, well, was this just my temporal lobe firing? I mean, is that what was going on? And he said, well, clearly there was a physical kind of manifestation, probably something about this woman's story, about the fact that you two were the same age, that you really related to her. It may have been that there was something about that that made this an emotional experience for you, an emotive experience. However, he said, you know, when two people are in love and they look at each other, their temporal lobes probably fire as well in an unusual pattern. Does that mean that the experience of love is not real? Does it mean it's just brain chemistry or brain electricity? He said, no, when it comes to things like spiritual experience, all you can say is it's possible. And so I guess what I'm saying is that with everything I looked at, Bob, there's always an alternative explanation. There's either a material explanation, like a reductionist explanation, or there's one that is perhaps spiritual. And I think it's very, I mean, the good news for people like me who believe there's more than this is that I think it's not, it's okay to believe. I mean, I found that it's okay. It's a rational thing to both respect science and have a belief in something more than this.
Mm-hmm. And it could be, I mean, what do you mean when you say it's more than this? What are you thinking in your mind? Like, are you mean not merely physical,
right,
or that it is merely physical here on this earth, but that its ultimate source is immaterial or something?
Well, I actually, maybe this is a little bit of dualism, which will get hoots and hollers from people, but I mean, I actually, my own sense is that I connected at that moment and in other subsequent moments with a kind of spiritual reality, something that we might not be able to see. Sometimes it's something that we often don't connect to because we're so busy thinking about filing the story on deadline or getting dinner on or the kind of the things that are immediately in front of us. We don't connect with this spiritual reality. But occasionally we do. William James talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think of it as something larger. I think in terms of God, but I don't necessarily think about the old man with the beard, the personal God. You talked about this in your book, that as you look more closely at science and science begins to fill in the gaps of God, it's harder and harder to think of a personal God That's what you said. I might take a little bit of issue with you on that, but the God that I can defend is this notion of a spiritual reality, maybe an infinite intelligence that stitches together the universe, that wires our brains to be able to connect. And so that is the kind of God I can defend.
Yeah. My reaction to that particular encounter, again, is what's striking is that it seems to have happened to you both at the same time. I mean, in that event, even assuming it's strictly material and its origins inside your brain and her brain, the timing is still would still be kind of mysterious, because it's really, the analogy that you made, or the scientist you consulted made, to two people in love, it's one thing when two people in love are staring in each other's eyes, and that's what's correlating the consciousness. I guess in this case, conceivably, it could be that she said this kind of, apparently she said the kind of thing that could kind of make your hair stand on end or something, right? I mean, she said, yeah. I mean, when somebody says, there are acts of heroism and courage that have this effect on people, right? That really inspire them. And when she said, okay, I've got cancer, but I think it's good and it's meant to be because it's going to allow me to, I don't know, experience transcendent meaning or whatever, I can imagine, you're getting kind of inspired in this way, and maybe her feeling the same thing. Maybe that's the explanation for the correlation.
It could be. I have to bring in the part that it's the most controversial part of the research that I looked at, and kind of hate to lead with it, but I will. I think some researchers, and legitimate ones, using NIH money, are looking at this notion of connection, that can one person's thoughts, especially within a bonded couple, can one person's thoughts affect another person's physiology? Mm-hmm. And this kind of research is being dismissed by a lot of scientists as parapsychology, but it's getting a little bit more robust. Where I witnessed an experiment out at a place called the Institute of Noetic Sciences, but it's been done at universities around the world, where essentially a husband was put into a electromagnetically shielded room, and his wife was put in another room. The camera's pointed at her. He has a computer screen in his room, and at random intervals for 10 seconds, her face will appear before him on the screen. Now, they are taking physiological measurements of both of them. In this case, it was pulse rate and kind of perspiration on their fingers. And what they found is that during those random intervals, when he looked at her for 10 seconds at a time and thought intentionally, he'd been practicing this through meditation and stuff, when he looked at her for 10 seconds, what they found is that, yes, his physiology responded to seeing her. That was expected. But that her physiology seemed to respond within about 2 seconds. Respond is the wrong word. Her physiology changed, mm-hmm. kind of upticked, within about 2 seconds. Now, the chances of this happening by chance were 11,000 to 1. And, there have been studies like this around the world. People explain it by saying, maybe it's quantum entanglement, maybe it's non-locality, maybe we are connected at some level. Mm-hmm. This is what mystics talk about. This is what everyone I spoke to who had dramatic spiritual experiences talked about, this notion of being connected with the grass, with other people, with the universe, the sense of your boundaries, physical boundaries falling. Mm-hmm. Now, this research may turn out it's just completely junk, but what's interesting to me, and the reason I put it in my book, knowing I'd probably be criticized for it, is that it does seem to tackle a question that I feel has not been adequately answered by material kind of reductionist science, which is that there does seem to be some, anecdotally or whatever you want to say, some evidence that one person's thoughts or prayers seem to affect another person's body. Now, maybe it's always coincidence. Maybe that's true. I was raised a Christian Scientist. We really care about things like prayer because we didn't take medicine and didn't go to doctors, mm-hmm. and things like that. So I have this kind of background in believing in the power of prayer. And perhaps that's why I was attracted to this research. But that those kind of explanations may be, or that those kind of ideas may be a way to explain what happened with Kathy Young and me. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it may just be that what she said really moved me, and that's what happened.
Yeah, although it had to move her at the same time, which again is plausible.
Yeah, it's plausible.
I want to get into your Christian Science background before long. Meanwhile, I'm wondering how widely replicated these studies are, because I think the Institute for Noetic Sciences has a reputation for being run by people who would kind of, maybe that's unfair, but people who would like to believe this
Absolutely.
Stuff, is that unfair?
No, that's very fair, and you know, I like them enormously. If I'd been able to go somewhere else, like the University of Washington is doing this kind of thing, Edinburgh, there are other places that are, University of Hawaii, that kind of thing. If in my time frame I could have gone somewhere else, mm-hmm. I would have. But you're right. They study consciousness and spirituality. They believe that there are these connections.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was really trying to do with this book is with this particular research is just to say, I think there are some things that are unexplainable.
Yeah.
Here's one that you can think about, quantum entanglement, for example, that isn't proven above the atomic level, but it actually in some ways might appeal more to scientists because it doesn't invoke a god who comes in and, you know, pokes one person and then pokes the other. Do you see what I mean? So at any rate,
Can I pause and say that I want to get into entanglement. But you know, I've never thought that the kind of thing you're describing, the kind of experiment you described, was beyond the pale of science to begin with. In other words, you know, our brains give off some sort of material emanations when we think. And in fact, I think now, don't they have it, haven't they gotten to the point where a person who, say, is a quadriplegic or something can, through focus, actually get a cursor to move on
yes,
a computer screen?
I've heard that.
So that means that shows you that you can, I think, as I understand that, that waves can move from your brain beyond your cranium and influence the physical world. If that is the case, and do so coherently,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, the thought itself is staying intact, or the intention is staying intact as it gets to whatever sensor in turn moves the cursor.
Right.
If it's the case that human brains do that, it's not beyond the pale to think that natural selection would
mm-hmm.
favor genes that led people to be sensitive to that information.
That's right.
It could come in handy to know what people are thinking about doing.
Absolutely.
So I wouldn't call that extra scientific, strictly speaking. But anyway, go on and say what you want to say about entanglement.
Oh, well, I didn't look a lot at entanglement. I just looked at it in the context of this research, this notion. I mean, I do find it fascinating that two particles, once connected, can be separated and then continue to behave as if they are still connected, as
right.
if they're the same particle. And Einstein calls it spooky. He's called it spooky action at a distance. I just think it's a really rich area that
yeah.
science needs to take a close look at and not dismiss.
And we should emphasize that it isn't just the case that they're correlated from the beginning and therefore they remain, their behavior remains correlated. In other words, it's not like separating twins
right.
at birth
right.
and then it turns out they both go bald at age 30 or something.
right.
right. I mean, that is a correlation that was present at birth. With these particles, it's different. It's like they say that when you measure one and thereby force it to collapse to a state that was in no sense predetermined,
right.
they say they know
right.
this. I don't know how. They say they know it. That in turn forces the other particle to assume a complementary state. So
right.
it's as if you were influencing, and it does so instantaneously, so it's as if you were influencing things miles away in no time at all.
Right, exactly. No time
which is
at all.
That, amazing.
Right.
Faster than the speed of light.
Right. You know what the Institute of Noetic Sciences folks told me is, they said, you know, Marilyn Schlitz, who runs the organization, said, you know, quantum physicists, a friend of mine who's a quantum physicist says, you know, I don't know why everyone gives you guys such a hard time. Quantum physics is way weirder than anything you guys are doing.
It's pretty weird.
It is pretty weird.
And I certainly think it's cause to just remain intellectually humble about what we might find out.
Right.
And I actually met Marilyn Schlitz at the Esalen Institute.
Oh, you did?
My closest flirtation with that world was I taught a little thing at the Esalen Institute, and it turned out I was not a very good guru, and so I went back to making a regular living.
Oh, I think you're an excellent guru. I'd
that
follow
was
you
not
anyway.
The consensus at Esalen, I assure you. I just didn't.
Right.
There was something missing. So what other kinds of weird things do you talk about? You put on the God helmet,
yes,
right?
Yes, I did. I put on the God helmet, and I want to talk about Pam Reynolds and near-death experiences in a
yes.
minute. Just talk about weird. That's weird. The God helmet. Have you heard of the God helmet?
I read John Horgan's
yes.
account of it in maybe Rational Mysticism
that's right.
or something.
That's right. He and I had somewhat the same experience. It was actually it was a very funny experience. You know, Michael Persinger is up at Laurentian University in Canada, and his theory, based on, you know, real neurology, his theory is that if you essentially tickle the right temporal lobe, you will, with electromagnetic waves, you will create, the person will have a sensed presence,
mm-hmm.
that they will feel as if there is someone else in the room, you know, kind of like Kathy Young and me sitting there at Saddleback Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up there and did this experiment with him. It was actually really, it's as low tech as you can possibly get. You sit in an isolated room with this, in this kind of deep, smelly chair, and they put this motorcycle helmet on you that has electrodes on it, and basically he just manipulates your temporal lobe a little bit. And what he would do, here's what was interesting about this, is I did not feel a sensed presence at all. In fact,
mm-hmm.
I thought the whole thing was kind of a sham.
Mm-hmm.
But then what I had done is I had put a microphone, because I was working for doing a story for NPR on this as well. I put a microphone out in the control room where he was, and he was essentially talking me through everything he was doing. So he'd say, "Okay, now I'm putting, you know, I'm manipulating this part of your brain now, and we're doing this kind of frequency or whatever." I couldn't hear him because I was in the other room, but he was speaking into the microphone. You could hear me because I was wearing a microphone, and what I was saying was being broadcast out there. Well, what was interesting is that he would say things like, "Okay, now you should see a funny little object up in your left peripheral vision in about, I don't know, 30 seconds, a minute."
Mm-hmm.
And then you would hear me say, "You know, I see a little goblin, you know, a little kind of face over my left peripheral vision." And this happened over and over again. And so what that told me is clearly by manipulating my temporal lobe,
mm-hmm.
he was creating these images.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't God. Let me
it
tell you.
It didn't feel religious.
It didn't feel the least bit religious. And but, you know, he comes away with this theory. It comes away with the theory that God is nothing more than an electrical firing in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really dispute that,
mm-hmm.
Because it was nothing like the experiences I've had in the few brief experiences I've had that are new.
So it's more like having like a little gob of stuff on your eye or
that's
something.
That's right.
Maybe you should call it the gob helmet instead of the God helmet.
That's right. That's right. But it was worth doing, and it humbled me a little bit because it really was proof to me that there is a material, there's a correlation between what you see or feel and what's going on in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense, of course.
Yeah, yeah, no, that makes total sense to me, and it certainly wouldn't surprise me if you could induce. I mean, look, you know, drugs are proof
absolutely.
That you can induce religious experience through, you know, biochemical means, right?
Right.
Now, and you had passing encounters with what, peyote or something?
Yeah,
how passing?
It was fairly passing. I mean, it's quite passing. I went up for a peyote to Arizona for a peyote ceremony, and
mm-hmm.
they, you know, they have the tea, they have the mush, the little buttons, and then they have this mash. And believe me, well, I don't know if you've had peyote, but it's not a culinary treat. It actually tastes pretty awful. I had kind of the first round.
I don't think people are in it for the taste.
Don't either. But I had it the first round, but I kind of wanted to be lucid. to observe what was going on, the whole peyote ceremony, and just to see what happened. I almost wish I hadn't been. It's a really long ceremony. It's 11 hours overnight from 9 p.m. to 8 a.m.
Oh, yeah. So, you should definitely be on drugs for something like that.
Everyone else looked a lot happier than I looked, than I felt, I should say. But so I didn't experience the psychedelics. But what I wanted to do was just see what happened, how people responded, just be in the scene mm-hmm. when people are having these mystical experiences. And in fact, they did. And the woman who was having for whom the ceremony was, who it was a healing ceremony. She wanted to get rid of her shingles, essentially. She had visions. She said she was forgiven by a man she believed she had been harmed 20 years ago, a man who kept haunting her. And in the middle of the night, she said, I'm healed. The peyote has healed me. Well, I thought, yeah, right, we'll reinvestigate this. We'll revisit this issue in 48 hours and see what happened. In fact, she never had shingles again, never was felt comfortable from then on. Now, you can say, okay, the peyote had some quality in it, the antibiotic quality that made the shingles go away, or it was the relief from the stress and the guilt. She felt she had been forgiven, and so that made the shingles go away. Or you could say, okay, Marianne visited another reality, and when she did that, she was healed. You can door number one, two, or three, you can decide what you want. But, there are some interesting studies. I'm sure you know about what's going on at Johns Hopkins.
Maybe not.
Oh, it's so interesting. There, after about 30 years where, thanks to Timothy Leary, the research on using psychedelic drugs was suspended. Mm-hmm. Now Johns Hopkins is actually doing studies using psilocybin, and they are seeing if they can spark a spiritual experience when they give people a capsule of psilocybin. And in fact, not surprisingly, they can. And this first round of studies, they've done a couple of studies now, and people have had full-blown mystical experiences, the kind of thing that I heard about in talking to people, the sense of timelessness, spacelessness, unity with God, the light, the love, all of those things that mystics talk about. They have these experiences.
Don't some of them have really horrible experiences?
Well, none in the Johns Hopkins study, partly because they've trained them they did a lot of training ahead of time, telling them what they'd experience, how to think about it, how to meditate, what to do if things start going bad. So there was a lot of training. It wasn't like, just going out to the woods and popping a pill. Mm-hmm. So these people haven't had bad experiences. What's interesting about this study is not so much that they sparked a spiritual experience. What's interesting is that now this opens the door for a whole new way to study spiritual experience. Because, of course, the thing about spiritual experiences, they're slippery little devils. You never know when one's going to come upon you. Mm-hmm. And you can't say, oh, okay, at 2 o'clock on Friday I'm going to have a spiritual experience. Let's just make an appointment so I can go into the brain scanner then and see what's happening in my brain. Well, what they can do now with Johns Hopkins is now that they have permission to do these things, is, give someone psilocybin, slip him into the brain scanner, see what neural networks are activated, and begin to have a sense for what's going on inside of the brain of a mystic, or at least synthetically. It's a synthetic spiritual experience. So I think what's happening is this is really going to open up the world, because they'll be able to look at spiritual experience in real time.
Huh. So this is the first time they've been able to use modern brain scanning technology.
That's right.
To study.
Right.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that there had been this moratorium that prevented that.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is they've now started a study with, I'll just mention this briefly, with people with cancer. And this is replicating studies that were done in the 50s and 60s. What researchers found at Hopkins and Chicago and other places is that when people had end-stage cancer and were given LSD, depending on what their trip was like, depending how mystical it was, if they had a trip that was very much like a mystical one, where they went into the light, they may have had something like a near-death experience, or they felt the light and the love and all of that, those people returned with often less pain, unconcerned about pain. But here's the other thing. They came back convinced that there was life after death. which is probably why their pain levels dropped. You know, that stress had been reduced. So they are now starting to replicate those studies and see what happens to people with cancer in a more methodical way, and seeing if they can have the same kind of beneficial effects.
And are these related to the near death experiences you alluded to?
Well, they aren't. I mean, the reason I alluded to them is because some of the same elements appear to be in both.
Right.
You know what's interesting is that it appears that there are many, many types of spiritual experience. You can have a drug experience. You can have a spontaneous mystical experience. You can do it through meditation and prayer. You know, the spiritual virtuosos who spend tens of thousands of hours in prayer. You can have a near-death experience, although I wouldn't recommend sticking a fork into a light socket. But but they often seem to have the same elements, which I find fascinating. It is a sense of light, timelessness, love, that all will be well, often an out-of-body experience. It very often seems to be the very same thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what the drug folks experienced, and that's what the people who had near-death experiences experienced.
I once did a one-week meditation retreat, and about day five, it was a silent meditation retreat, about day five while meditating, I had an experience as dramatic,
oh, really?
I'm sure, as any of these. Yeah.
You're kidding.
No.
Well, tell.
No, I don't want to. I mean, I can tell you that overall, independent of this particular experience, there was a really fairly dramatic transformation of just my everyday consciousness.
Wow.
But that's separate from this kind of, peak experience that was, was like entering another realm.
Did you kind of view reality in a different way?
Well, it's hard to separate the effect of that one experience on that, like, Thursday night from the really, again, fairly dramatic, gradually transformative experience of just the ongoing silent meditation. Mm-hmm. So by day six or seven, I was just, every waking moment was a different person from the person I had been, but that had been kind of growing all along. I was becoming, kind of less self-centered, less grasping, less judgmental, more open to just viewing the rest of the world more charitably. So that happened, I think, anyway, and independent of this. And then this was pretty weird. I don't have any reason to think that you can't explain it all physiologically. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're gradually putting your brain in a different kind of state as you undergo a discipline like that. It was really intense meditation every day. You're not talking to anyone. No news from the outside world.
Right.
I'm here to tell you, yes, it can happen.
If I can just jump in, Buddhists, Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin has been practicing Buddhist meditation for a long time, and he believes it's a brain state. He doesn't believe you connect with a different reality. So I think it's easy. You can look at it either way.
But you can also say, and this gets back to William James, and I guess I do kind of make this point in passing in my book that natural selection did not design the brain to perceive ultimate reality or ultimate truths, or even very large truths, really. I mean, it designed the brain to get genes into the next generation, and that involved focusing on things like eating, having sex, gaining social status, being nice to people sometimes, mean other times. I mean, a fairly mundane set of tasks. So there's no reason to think that ordinary consciousness is anything like an objective or profound view of reality in all its depths. And there, in fact, there's every reason to think that we are generally prevented from attaining any depth or true objectivity. So even if, any given meditation technique or drug or whatever does a strictly physical thing to your brain, okay, that doesn't mean it's not actually moving your awareness closer to what the objective truth is, okay?
Right.
It could just happen to do that. It could just happen that when you manipulate the brain in a certain way, you're kind of decreasing the power of some filter we normally, I'm pretty open-minded in that regard. In other words, it could be a strictly physical manipulation that just by making the human brain a little less of a blinding kind of thing,
Right.
opens you up.
Right.
But
you know, and Aldous Huxley has the metaphor of the brain being a reducing valve. And that, which is just what you're talking about, that most
right.
of the time we couldn't possibly,
right.
that we have access to this, you know, mind at large is what he calls it, but we couldn't possibly compute all that information, all the thoughts, all the, you know, all the information that's in the universe. We couldn't compute it. We'd die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd be eaten by the lion in the bush because
mm-hmm.
we'd be thinking about the heavens, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But he had this view that sometimes, maybe it's random, it's spontaneous, maybe it's drugs. He liked drugs a lot, of course. But,
yeah, his book, Doors of Perception,
right.
was about his taking, what, mescaline
right.
or
that's
something.
Right. And so, you know, he thinks that there are some things that seem to open the filter where
mm-hmm.
we are somehow able to access that larger reality. But it's brief. Those moments are brief, and they don't come to everyone.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so there were specific near-death experiences that you talk about in the book?
I did, and you know, I was not convinced that there's life after death after
mm-hmm.
talking to, I mean, really dozens of people about their near-death experiences. I went to the near-death experience meeting. They have it every 2 years in Houston at MD Anderson in Houston in 2006. And so there were like 300 people who had near-death experiences. And they all described the same thing, which is an argument, actually, that it is just physiological. This is what a brain does when it's shutting down. It creates,
and what is that thing that they describe?
Well, they describe, many of them describe the tunnel, seeing the light,
mm-hmm.
seeing past relatives. The relatives look the way they often did. They often look the way they did the last time they saw them. They often saw beings of light. Some people saw it as, you know, Jesus or Moses. One person said he saw Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston.
Ooh, I would call that a subpar near-death experience. But
I wasn't convinced that those experiences show that there's life after death. Probably the most provocative person I talked to in this whole area of near-death experiences was a woman named Pam Reynolds, and I'll just briefly tell you her story. In 1991, she suddenly was unable to talk, and she
mm-hmm.
went to see her neurologist, and he said, "You've got this huge brain aneurysm right on your brain stem." It's 1991. There weren't a lot of sophisticated, they didn't have a whole lot of sophisticated ways to get at it. So she did a fairly risky operation called a standstill operation. And essentially what they did is they flew her out to Arizona to Barrow Neurological Institute. They cooled down her body temperature to the 60s, stopped her heart, drained the blood out of her head like oil from a car engine. Then they could go in, snip the aneurysm because it had collapsed for lack of blood, stitch it up, warm the blood up, you know, put it back in her body, and after 8 hours she would be supposedly back to normal without that brain aneurysm. So, but what was interesting about her case is she was under deep anesthesia. I interviewed several people, but including the neurosurgeon who did the surgery. She's under deep anesthesia. Her eyes were taped shut, and her ears had clickers in them so that they made clicking sounds about the sound of 90 to 100 decibels, which is about what it sounds like when a jet is taking off from a tarmac.
Hmm.
So, and that was to see if there was any brainstem activity so that they could, when they saw there was no brainstem activity, they could then cool her down enough and drain the blood from her head. Okay. Now, what was interesting is when she came back, she could describe large parts of the operation. Now, what I should say is she could describe... Now, this was before the blood was taken out of her head, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So she still had... She might have had some residual brain activity.
Mm-hmm.
But her eyes were taped shut, her ears had these clickers, and she was under anesthesia. She could describe the bone saw, the Midas Rex bone saw that was used. It looked like an electric toothbrush. She heard conversations like when one of the surgeons said her left femoral vein is too small, and the other surgeon said, "Oh, then go to her right." She could describe who was standing where, how many people were in the room. After her near-death experience, because in the middle of this she had a near-death experience where she saw her grandmother and all of that went to the light. After she had that, she then saw them resuscitate her. Now,
Did they in fact resuscitate
yes,
her?
Yes, twice.
And she recalled observing that yes. from like above
yes,
the, above them.
Yes,
which is common, is that right?
That is common. And this whole thing, everything she saw was from above, like the left shoulder of the chief neurosurgeon.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very common. These out of body experiences are common, and I think they can be explained generally. What I like about her story, though, is. Well, the neurosurgeon really believed that she did not have enough, if she had any brain activity at mm-hmm. all, it wasn't enough to form or retain memories
mm-hmm.
and a coherent narrative. What he said to me, I talked to him about a half an hour about it, and he said, I have no scientific explanation, but it's changed the way I think about reality. And this is, you know, a neurosurgeon. The other thing I like is that a doctor went back, someone who was interested in this case, went back and got all the records from the surgery and could tell what was happening when, according to the records.
Mm-hmm.
And everything she said checked out. It checked out kind of in the right time frame. I mean, obviously she wasn't saying, okay, it's 11:15, now I'm hearing a conversation by the surgeon, but it was close enough. You could
yeah.
tell what they were doing and when she heard
yeah.
things and when she saw things. Now, what this suggests to me, and maybe it's explainable by material means. I mean,
could be conceivably.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't kill her after
no, they
all.
Didn't
I mean,
kill
they
her.
Drained the blood, but there was some organic activity in the brain.
That's right.
But, yeah.
They didn't kill her. And I interviewed someone who believes it's fully explainable.
Mm-hmm.
What at least it raises a question for me, the question it raises for me is it possible that consciousness can continue when the brain isn't functioning well? Now, let's say her brain was functioning, but wonder if it wasn't functioning well enough to form or retain memories. Is it possible somehow that consciousness, her brain was still able in some way to continue functioning?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer may be no, Bob. It may be no. It may be that this is fully explainable. I just think it's a provocative idea. And, of course, this is a debate that's raging in neuroscience right now, is the nature of consciousness.
Right.
And this whole mind-brain question.
Right.
So, to me, it was fascinating. It was a wonderful story to hear, and it really made me think a lot. And to tell you the truth, it gave me a little bit of hope that, you know, my mom is going to be 88 in August, and she's just about my best friend, and I would like to think maybe there's a possibility that in some form she will continue to exist.
Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
It would be nice.
And speaking of your mom, you were raised a Christian Scientist, right?
That's right. That's right.
And talk about that. I had never really had much of a conversation with a Christian Scientist until I happened to be sitting next to him on an airplane a few months ago. And, you know, he seemed like a perfectly reasonable guy. but there is this issue about medical treatment where he and I diverge. And, you know, in reading your account, I had not realized, I mean, I knew the idea was that, you know, you don't need the medicine to cure you. I hadn't realized that the idea is also that the pain you're feeling is, what, in some sense illusory, or is
That's
it a
right.
product of your mind? It's not intrinsic in your being?
That's right. That's right. I mean, it feels like there's an Asian influence, some, you know, Buddhism or Hinduism or something in Christian Science, although Mary Baker Eddy lived in the 1800s and never traveled out of New England, so I'm not sure how she got that influence. But it is a sense that what we are, this waking consciousness that you and I would call reality, is actually an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that the spiritual reality, the qualities that make up Bob Wright, you know, the intelligence or the humor or all of those qualities, that those qualities can never be destroyed. It's like the number seven. You can't destroy the number seven because it's an idea. So the idea of Christian Science is that your identity is a spiritual identity, and that this body is a manifestation of this spiritual identity, but it's flawed. It's like, the best analogy I heard is, it's like looking in a mirror, and if you take lipstick and, you know, put it on the mirror, the mirror, the image that you see on the mirror is flawed. It's got
mm-hmm.
lipstick all over it. But you do not, right? You, the reality, the real person,
mm-hmm.
do not.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
that's what sickness is. It's lipstick all over
mm-hmm.
all over the image.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you can only kind of tap into the spiritual truths that Christian Science talks about, mm-hmm. And see yourself as the perfect idea of God, for example, mm-hmm. then everything else, the human, you know, conforms to the divine. That's what they say, that your sickness will go away, your, if you do it right, you know, your unemployment issues will be solved, you know, all of that, that this material life is just a reflection of the spiritual life, and we can correct the material life by correcting what we think about the spiritual life.
You know, that's not totally unrelated to one way of thinking about consciousness that is kind of Eastern and mystical, and maybe, I don't know if I've heard this or just kind of patched it together myself in thinking about this meditation retreat, but and thinking about kind of the brain as something created by natural selection and therefore a far from reliable guide to what the reality that's actually out there probably, just that, and it has to do with the mind-body problem. I mean, if you think of the metaphysics of consciousness such that kind of there is such thing as pure contemplative awareness, mm-hmm. but when you take this stuff and encase it in an organic brain, or maybe that's a misleading metaphor, but anyway, the portion of it we are allotted by virtue of having brains is intrinsically distorted, kind of.
Right.
And that meditative practice and so on can remove some of those distortions. That's really just an analogy for what you're talking about, I would say. Well, what the Christian Scientists are saying. It's not nearly the same thing, but there are interesting kind of parallels there.
No, they're absolutely related. And I have to say, Bob, that I witnessed healings. Now, the most convincing healings, I think, are fully explainable through material means. That mm-hmm. is, when I would pray for myself. I have an instance in there. One of my most dramatic, what I consider, healings was when I had scarlet fever when I was, about 13, and prayed for myself. And I remember being kind of in the bathroom. I was and I was lying down on that cold tile floor, and it just felt so soothing on my face, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember lying there and suddenly having this, seeing myself from above. I realize now it was kind of this out of body experience, and somehow being able to tease apart my spiritual identity from that body I saw on the floor. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? And within about an hour, all vestiges of that, the scarlet fever, were gone. I felt fine. Now, I think that's explainable through material means, that your thoughts, my thoughts, do affect my brain chemistry, which affect my body. I mean, we know this to be the case. The harder issue is, can my thoughts affect your body? Can my prayers affect your body? And that one's the one we kind of already talked about that's so controversial. But I mean, I did witness healings enough that I think they shouldn't be dismissed. We'll put it that way.
Healings, I mean, I don't have a clear idea of what a healing is like in Christian Science. I have an idea of how faith healers work on TV, but yeah. What do you mean by healing?
Well, in Christian Science, I mean, generally I'm talking about physical healings. So, you know, you have the flu and you pray about it and you get better really fast.
Okay.
That's generally what I'm talking about. Although they talk about healings of relationships, that when you pray about your relationship, that kind of thing.
But, of course, people get better sometimes just anyway, right? It happens.
Absolutely. It happens. And I must say that I am not, I'm very happy that I discovered Tylenol. You know, I didn't leave Christian Science till I was...
Yeah, Tylenol is apparently what led you away from Christian Science. Imagine how fast some other drugs would have done the trick.
It was amazing. It was an eye-opening experience.
Because they had claimed that the discomfort associated with fever or whatever was in your head, and when you saw that something physical could change it.
That's right. It took me a little while to finally leave Christian Science. I mean, I'd been moving away from it for, I was, let's say, about 32 at the time. I'd been moving away from it for about, 10 years or so. But my brother, who had already left Christian Science, kept saying to me, "You can't leave Christian Science until Mom and Dad die, because it would it would break their hearts." So I remained in the religion more out of kind of obligation and loyalty to my parents. But then when I hit... When I popped that Tylenol, I mean, my world changed. It rocked my world.
That's a dangerous drug, Tylenol. But you remain a Christian or not?
Yes, I am. Uh-huh. I am. I'm kind of what I think of, C.S. Lewis talks about near Christianity. kind of a pretty straight, you know,
a pretty unadorned version pretty of a Christian.
That's right, pretty unadorned version. I find it tragic that kind of Christianity is as divided as it is right now, covering the Episcopal Church and, you know, all the political fights and all of that. My faith is quite apolitical.
Mm-hmm. So, well, how did your mother handle the news? I mean, my mother would have been so delighted if I had remained any kind of Christian. You know,
that's right. That's
but,
right.
But I mean, so you should have stressed the good news.
The good news. She was such a class act. I have to tell you, she just said, "Honey, I am so happy that you found something that really makes you happy and that fulfills you." Mm-hmm. And so she was absolutely terrific. And we remain, as I mentioned, you know, we remain just very, very, very good friends. And we see eye to eye. Interestingly, Bob, this book, my research, has made me realize that Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science were, you know, 100 years ahead of their time in terms of understanding the mind-body connection.
Mm-hmm.
They were way ahead of the scientists. And so I actually gained an increased respect for Christian Science. Not that I would give up Tylenol or going to the doctors, but I do have a respect for Christian Science and the power of thinking.
Right. You can exert. I mean, the things that these meditators can do.
Yeah.
I mean, remember the footage of during the Vietnam War when monks would immolate themselves in protest, and they would not flinch.
I know.
They would go up in flames and just sit there.
I know.
Now, that's pretty amazing.
That is it. But don't try this at home.
Don't try this at home. The pain may be in your head, but the death isn't.
That's so true.
So that's now there have been studies, right, of intercessionary prayer where people prayed about sick people, and haven't they generally found that the people don't get well by and large?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the early studies in the 80s and 90s seemed to show some effect, but people feel those studies were flawed. They weren't as rigorous as they could have been. The more recent studies, especially the big one in Harvard a couple of years ago, showed that either there was no effect or that the people who were prayed for actually got worse.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
Now, you know, there are a lot of possible explanations. Maybe people knew they were being prayed for. This is what Ann Harrington at Harvard believes is, you know, people found out they were being prayed for in this study and thought, oh, my gosh, I must be really sick if everyone's praying for me. But
always a bad sign when hundreds of people are praying for you, yeah.
But, you know, I actually think, Bob, that those, even those studies, the ones that show no effect, may be flawed, and that there's a whole new set of studies coming online. The reason I think they're flawed is they didn't really replicate the way prayer is done. They generally had a stranger praying for a stranger from a script.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's how it works. I think generally,
You would think that that's not what God's looking for,
right,
if there's a God.
Right, exactly.
Now, you think...
That's where you get into the whole, you know, I mean, Cleveland Clinic is looking at things, at studies, doing a study with NIH money, which looks at people who know each other, praying for each other. So I think there are a new set of studies coming online that are smaller and that look at more intimate relationships and see if there's any effect. And so I think the jury's still out about whether prayer works or not.
Of course, there's separately the question of, you know, whether what kind of God would decide which people to save based on who they know, whether they happen to know Christians.
But
I guess we're not getting into theology
but you
here.
You know, I mean, it's true. That's, you bump up against that kind of question all the time. I bumped up against it in, you know, there's very little research about whether there's a God gene or not. Dean Hamer wrote a book about, called The God Gene, but it turns out that VMAT2, that so-called God gene, accounted for less than 0.5% of the variation of spirituality between people, right? So it's not it's not really the main, it's not Zeus, we'll put it that way. But it does appear that people, that there is a genetic, that there is, spirituality runs in families.
Yeah.
There does seem to be a genetic component. And they see that from twin studies and things like that. And it raises a question, you know, what kind of God would give some people the capacity to connect easily with him or her or it, and then others not? And especially if you have the whole idea of heaven and hell. You know, God, I mean, there's Calvinism, right? I mean, that what kind of God would consign people to heaven or hell based on their genetic makeup? And
yeah.
Those are tough questions. And I think, you know, for me personally, that's not the kind of God I subscribe to. I don't really have that notion of consigning one to heaven or hell.
Well, what denomination are you now within Christianity?
Well, you know, I've been going to an Episcopal church, but mm-hmm. covering this church is really, I'm actually now looking around. I mean, I think of myself just as Protestant because I mm-hmm. wasn't born into any particular Protestant religion except mm-hmm. for Christian Science. It's a little easier for me to graze, so yeah. to speak, and try Presbyterian or Methodism or whatever. I liked Episcopalianism because my husband is a former Catholic and it was somewhere that we could kind of meet in the middle.
Right.
But
certain amount of ritual.
Right, exactly. Right. But as I said, it's a little hard in the Episcopal Church to actually find unadulterated theology without yeah. politics. So I'm kind of looking around right now.
Yeah, you know, on the God gene thing, when I was researching my book and getting into the anthropology of shamans,
uh-huh.
and there were these reports that in a number of societies, shamans may actually use their exalted status to increase the number of sex partners they have.
Mm.
It occurred to me that, in theory, having and believing that you are having, like, transcendent experiences, to the extent that there was a gene conducive to that, the gene could spread, in theory, mm-hmm. if indeed it's leading you to have more
right.
Sex. But that's my
so
only.
So we call it the sex gene, or what do we call it?
Well, yeah, all genes are in a certain sense sex genes, at least in the sense that they manage to get transmitted via sexual reproduction. This one does it in a particularly interesting way. If it does it, it's just a hypothesis. But there were also in the anthropology they noted how the classic temperament of a shaman was the type of temperament we sometimes associate with just the artist, you know,
mm-hmm.
with intense creativity mm-hmm. that sometimes involves a degree of neurosis or even periodic psychosis, you know.
Right.
And that all to the anthropologist seemed bundled up with intense kind of spirituality, I guess.
Well, the mystics would be, you know, I think many people would argue that some of the mystics had some of those very same traits.
Yeah.
So so clearly I think there is a genetic component there.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to say about your book?
About my book?
It is fascinating. I mean, I could talk all day about this stuff.
Well, me too. In fact, I have been talking all day. I've got to say it was, let's see. I guess I'll end kind of where we began, which was the comforting. There will be no real answers, slam dunk answers for either a believer or a non-believer in looking at the science. I mean, I think of this emerging science of spirituality as kind of a Rorschach test, that you come to it with your worldview. So I would talk to scientists who would say, see, like Michael Persinger, see, God is nothing but brain chemistry or brain firing, so temporal lobe firing. But that was his worldview ahead of time. And then you would have other people whom I'd interview, other scientists, who would say, you know, look, this is a connection. What you're seeing in your brain is a reflection of a connection with a higher power, with a different reality. And of course it's going to be reflected in your brain. But he also came, the person I'm thinking of, also came with a worldview that was open to spiritual experience. And so at the end of the line, I think I don't have any definitive answers. That's probably why it'll never be a number one bestseller, because I don't have any definitive
Although
answers.
Although it's been selling pretty well, right?
It's been doing pretty well.
Yeah.
It's been doing pretty well, yes. But having said that, the great comfort I got is that I think that you can be a well-educated person who believes in science, who can also believe in a spiritual reality. I mean, I think I kind of wrote this book for me, actually. But I wrote it for people who say, you know, or at a party and someone says, oh, have you read The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins? Anyone who thinks that there's such a thing as a God is, you know, an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to be able to say, yeah, but, you know, I read this book by this NPR reporter, and she talked to a lot of scientists, and there may be kind of circumstantial evidence mm-hmm. of a spiritual reality. I just am happy to think that it's a possibility and that it's not just delusion. So that's, I guess, it's a modest claim. It's a modest victory, but it's one that I'm happy with.
Well, I'm in favor of modesty. and I would say Richard Dawkins doesn't have as much as you, probably.
Well, he probably doesn't need to have as much as I do.
I don't know about that. You definitely have a book you could be very proud of.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for taking the time and sticking with us through the technical travails.
It was really fun, Bob. Thank you so much. And you have a great book as well. I've really enjoyed it.
People need
to buy it.
People, that's the take-home lesson of my book, really. If you want me to summarize its message in a single sentence, is buy it or burn in the hellfires forever. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Barbara.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.